14. Wild Times in Jackson Hole. The wild country was right in the Howard clan's wheelhouse, a western intended for family viewing. In the 1880s, the Tanners of Pittsburgh seek a new start on a ranch in Wyoming. They are a father, a mother, and two boys, Andrew and Virgil. That would be Clint and me. When they finally arrive at their destination, the Tanners discover that they have been swindled into buying a dilapidated farmhouse that sits on arid land. To make matters worse, their water source is a river that flows first through the adjacent land of a rich, mean rancher named Ab Cross. It's basically There Will Be Blood for kids. The Tanner parents were played by Steve Forrest, a handsome actor who later starred in the 1970s TV series SWAT, and Vera Miles, who had played Clint's mother in the Gentle Giant movie. The four of us were co-leads, but my story was the through line. Virgil transforms from a city boy into a capable rancher who has the guts to shoot Ab Cross dead at the movie's climax, right when Ab is about to kill Virgil's father. It was a coming-of-age story for my character and a coming-of-age summer for me. We shot the movie in July and August of 1969 on location just outside the town of Jackson Hole, Wyoming. In a circumstance that was by now familiar, Dad was given a supporting role as one of Ab's henchmen and was hired in an official capacity as a dialogue coach for Clint and me. Quickly earning the trust of the movie's higher-ups, he also became an informal script consultant. Drawing upon his ranching background and knowledge of the Western frontier to correct certain turns of phrase that the writers got wrong. Mom came along for the duration, too. We had all been together in Miami for Gentle Ben, but Mom and I were only visitors to Dad and Clint's show. This time, the entire family was in on the same adventure. Along with the rest of the cast and crew, we stayed in town in a two-story motel called the Grandview. The director was Robert Totten, who was to become a significant figure in our lives. Totten was a Sam Peckinpah-like figure whose career didn't turn out as well as Peckinpah's. Like Peckinpah, who earned his stripes as a director on the TV western The Rifleman, Totten established himself directing episodes of Gunsmoke. He, too, aspired to create muscular, unsentimental neo-Western movies, but he never quite turned that corner. He was too self-destructive, too prone to rage, and heavy drinking. He was only 32 when we met him, though, still full of promise. Totten was bearded, short, and stout, built like a fireplug, and a little intimidating, but that was part of why I liked him. He was the first director not to treat me with kid gloves. The second day of shooting, we filmed a scene where I unloaded some chickens in cages from our horse-drawn wagon. I wore a tweed traveling suit, and I noticed that some chicken poop had gotten on one of my cuffs and left a smear. We were about to roll camera when I raised my hand to get Totten's attention. "Do we need to do something about this?" I asked, displaying my cuff. Totten had no patience for my query. "What are you, a city boy?" he said. "You got a little chicken shit on your arm? Get over it." Then he shouted, "Roll!" This was more than a little moment. He issued a challenge to me to toughen up and get on with my work like a man, and I dug it. I was taken by Totten's swagger and the buzz that he clearly got from filmmaking. He had been a working director since his early 20s, which impressed the hell out of me. Suddenly, my mental timeline for when I would direct my first feature was compressed from decades to years. When Totten learned of my aspirations, he softened a little and took me under his wing, explaining the ways he positioned his cameras and composed his shots, and telling me how he varied his directorial approach from actor to actor, depending upon their psychological makeup and the needs of the scene. Totten was a good draftsman and occasionally sketched out his scenes in advance. For example, the movie has a big tornado sequence. He drew his vision of it on a large pad, plotting the series of shots he needed while discussing his ideas with the cameraman. I watched and listened, rapt. This was the first time I truly absorbed a director's explanation of the options at his disposal and the choices he was making. The only other director I had seen so deeply engaged in the cinematic process was Vincent Minnelli when we made The Courtship of Eddie's Father. But that was way back in 1962 when I was 8 years old, too young to appreciate what I was witnessing. To teenage me, Totten was a film guru. Also, I was struck by his wife, Sandy, who was petite, pretty, friendly, elegant, and, file this away for future reference, had beautiful red hair.
We were all enamored of Bob Totten. He called me Putt-Putt, because whenever the movie required me to run across the fields and corrals, I ran with determination, but not a lot of speed. He said that I reminded him of a little scooter that putt-putts along the road. As someone who has made a lot of B-grade movies, I can tell you that no director actually sets out to make one. Even if the budget is tiny and it's a slasher flick, the filmmaker believes from the get-go that he is making the ultimate, most top-shelf slasher flick. Totten was like that with The Wild Country. He was dealt the hand of directing a Disney B-Western, but he was going to shape it into an important piece of cinema. It didn't quite work out that way, but it's a decent film with some strong performances. Ab Cross was played by Morgan Woodward, a serial Hollywood bad guy whose menacing presence on screen belied how gentle he was in real life. The scary-looking but benevolent trapper who befriends the Tanners was played by Jack Elam, one of the foremost character actors in the Western genre. If you look him up, you'll recognize him. He had a long face, bushy eyebrows, and a wonky eye that was his signature. Someone had stabbed it with a pencil when he was a kid. Totten and Dad formed a bond because they shared a pioneer work ethic and were most at home in Westerns. Whenever I looked at Dad as an actor, I thought cowboy, horseman, farmer, more than private detective. The Western was already in decline by the time we did The Wild Country, but he and Totten were interested in seeing where they could take the genre. The production was a real manly man's environment. Totten brought over a lot of wranglers and stuntmen from Gunsmoke. Elam was a serious gambler, and he usually had a card game going near the dressing rooms. With a whiskey in his hand, he taught Ron and me how to play liar's poker and hearts. He gave us instructions that he took very seriously, such as, always bring the amount of money to a card game that you're prepared to lose. The town of Jackson Hole was filled with pool halls and cowboy bars. The crew guy sometimes reported to work the next morning with busted lips and black eyes, all in a good night's fun. It really was more like the Wild West than the affluent resort area it is today. For Ron and me, Jackson Hole meant liberation. Mom and Dad allowed us to do stuff in town by ourselves. We spent our per diem money on silver dollars that we bought in tourist shops and bottle rockets that we set off in the open fields where we were making the movie. The Wild Country's crew was an idiosyncratic mix of cowboys and hippies, bound together by a love of the great outdoors. In the latter category was an animal trainer named Dan Haggerty, before he became famous as an actor in his 70s TV show The Life and Times of Grizzly Adams. I spent a lot of time with him since the character I played, Andrew, had a menagerie of animals, a mare, a hawk, some chickens, all of whom he named Ralph. Haggerty had a sidekick trainer, a fellow hippie named Bullet. Just Bullet. And they had big beards and wore moccasins that looked homemade. I just thought these guys were really friggin' cool. Maybe it was the serendipity of having already worked with animals and good old boys on Gentle Ben, but I had never felt happier than I did making The Wild Country. It was summer, so there was no studio school, no breaks for studying, and I was really in the pocket acting-wise with my family around me. Ron and I had spent tons of time together at home, but never like this, as colleagues on a movie set. Our closeness only made our collaboration easier. And whenever I looked up, I saw Dad palling around with Totten and Mom chatting it up with Vera Miles. It was idyllic.
That was a summer of sexual awakening for me, too. I met a cute local girl named Dion and went on a couple of dates with her. The rodeo was in town, and we went together, watching with amusement as some Wild Country crew members recklessly volunteered and were thrown like rag dolls off a bucking bull. I was woefully inexperienced with girls. I'd briefly had a girlfriend in eighth grade, but our dates were basically playdates, sprinkled with pathetically tentative attempts at kissing. I had also been on a kind of date with Donna Butterworth, the girl singer who had appeared with me on the Danny Kaye Show. Donna and I did a Disney TV movie together called A Boy Called Nothing, and we junketed together to Disneyland for a promotional appearance when I was 14 and she was 12. I sensed an opportunity on that trip and leaned in for a kiss. Donna was amenable, but she had already started smoking and her lips tasted of cigarettes. I was traumatized by my mom's struggles with smoking and the damage it had done to her health, so that romance never took. Nothing happened with Dion either, but sheesh, I was 15, my voice had broken, and I was growing impatient. My sexual antennae were up, and I picked up on a certain charge in the air at the Grandview Motel, an atmosphere of hanky-panky. Not that I needed to be that perceptive. The motel was like a Navy warship hitting port. The adults involved with our shoot were real libertines after hours. And whereas I had always gone home to Burbank when I was shooting the Andy Griffith Show, this time I was on location, sharing barracks with the crew, privy to their extracurricular adventures. Clint and I had our own rooms at the Grandview, and the guy in the room adjacent to mine was a player. My sleep was frequently interrupted by his and his lover's moanings and thumpings. On top of that, one of our hairstylists, Jackie Bone, was in the midst of a long-term but secret affair with Burt Lancaster. I saw him one weekend, a tall man surreptitiously ducking into a room on the second floor. The following Monday, the other hairstylists were teasing Jackie, and she flashed a cat-that-ate-the-canary smile. The Wild Country taught me a lot about how adults went about their sexual business. The wanton world of Disney, who knew? But there was a downside to this uninhibited environment that wasn't amusing at all. Though Clint and I weren't in school, and our parents were present, California's child labor laws were among the nation's most rigid, and we were required during the making of The Wild Country to have a welfare worker on set. Let's call her Mrs. Baker. She was a middle-aged woman who was a stickler for following the rules to the letter. This drove Totten nuts, because we had to do a lot of night shooting. As we neared 11 o'clock, Mrs. Baker notified him that Clint and I were required to stop at 11 on the dot. Totten wanted to keep going until 11:30. Dad was inclined to let it slide and look the other way, but Mrs. Baker was inflexible. This standoff was embarrassing to 15-year-old me. I had plenty of energy and was happy to keep working. Yet I was still a minor, and therefore still subject to someone else effectively telling me, "It's time to go to bed, Ronnie." California has since eased up a bit on these rules, but the limitations placed on actors my age were a big reason that I struggled to get hired over the next 3 years. None of this is any excuse for what happened to Mrs. Baker. One night, when we were between setups, I heard a howl of terror. From the distance, she came running, seemingly for her life. In pursuit was a male makeup artist on the film, inebriated. He tackled her, pinned her to the ground, and started kissing her. The crew members, rather than intervene, simply observed this scene and laughed, cheering the guy on. Mrs. Baker managed to get back up on her feet. She socked the guy in the face. Undaunted, he tackled her again and started dry-humping her in front of everyone. When Mrs. Baker finally broke free for good, she ran off crying. I never saw her again. She was sent home in a car that night and replaced by a new welfare worker the following day. I was shaken by the way Mrs. Baker had been treated. Totten and the other powers that be shrugged off her assault with a boys-will-be-boys nonchalance. even my parents, though they agreed that what happened was awful, took a cold view of the why of the incident. "Well, she made everybody mad," Dad said, like that made it okay. Totten didn't fire the makeup artist or even discipline him. The responsibility for the assault never seemed to be assigned to its instigator. At the time, I was left more confused than angry by what I had witnessed. How could people be so fun and seemingly good-hearted, yet sanction something so terrible? But since then, I have come to recognize how toxic the culture of filmmaking was for women when I was a child actor. And it was too slow to improve. When my daughter Bryce entered the business 20 years ago, memories of this incident came rushing back and I shuddered. I had deep concerns for her emotional and, yes, physical safety. Fortunately, our industry has finally begun to evolve into a safer, more respectful one. But it took the Me Too movement and strong women like Bryce to begin in earnest the process of bringing about wholesale change rather than incremental measures. This change has been too long in coming and can't become the norm soon enough. Our time in Jackson Hole coincided with the Manson family murders, in which 7 people were killed in 2 separate attacks in Los Angeles. The news cast a pall on our team, since we were mostly LA people. And we sensed that the violence that had taken the lives of Martin Luther King and Bobby Kennedy a year earlier had now come to our doorstep. We didn't yet know who the killers were. There was only a widespread sentiment based on reports that they had written "Rise" and "Death to Pigs" on the walls in the victim's blood, that the revolution was to blame. For a relative innocent like me, this was another source of confusion. There were components of the 1960s cultural revolution that appealed to me, like rock music, the unapologetically transgressive films of Sam Peckinpah and Mike Nichols, and the anti-war movement. But was this part and parcel of a wider revolution that was killing people? I was also aware that the movie we were making was throwback entertainment, bearing little to no relation to 1969 cultural mores, despite Bob Totten's maverick intentions. Where did I fit into the new cultural wave? It was a lot to process. No matter what, I was pleased with the performances that Clint and I turned in, especially Clint's. His character, Andrew, carries the emotional weight of the film, dealing with the fallout as his family's unity is pushed to the breaking point by one setback after another. A tornado. Ab Cross's harassment, a fire. When Vera Miles fights with Steve Forrest in one scene threatening to move back to Pittsburgh, Clint performs the most convincing childhood breakdown I've ever seen. He cries tears of fear and heartbreak as he witnesses the worst thing a kid his age can witness, his parents screaming at each other, apparently coming apart.
Someone on the Wild Country set said that I was a little method actor. That's the first time I ever heard the term. I asked Dad what it meant. He described it as getting so inside the character that you really become him in the moment. One of Dad's great gifts was his ability to distill the actor's studio approach into something that Ron and I could grasp and execute. But I looked at it the other way around. The character became me. Was this a child's egocentric view of himself as the center of the world? Sure, but it was an approach that worked. I believed that I was more interesting than any character that someone might write. So I viewed the script as a set of parameters and circumstances dictating how I, Clint, might behave. The resident Indian sage in the Wild Country was named Two Dog, played by Frank DeCova, an Italian-American character actor whose dark skin and broad features earned him a long career playing Indians and Mexicans. This sort of casting would never happen now. The role would certainly and rightfully be given to a Native American. But that is not a rap on DeCova, who was a sweet person. He had played a Mexican colonel in Viva Zapata, which starred Marlon Brando. On the set, Frank tousled my hair and said, "Clint, you remind me of Brando." I had no idea who Brando was at that point, but today I would happily accept the compliment. Hanging with Jackie Lim and Frank Dacova proved crucial to me, in that I saw something of myself in them. It was the first time I understood that I was not the same kind of actor that Ron was. He was more of a leading man, bearing a certain weight of responsibility to carry a film. I was not. I was a character actor. In Elam, Dacova, and a hilarious old-timer in the film named Dub Taylor, I recognized my tribe, my peeps. I was not going to be the Steve Forrest of any given picture, but the Jack Elam. This epiphany granted me permission to be more fearless, more off the wall, the actor I became as an adult. Disney flew us home from Jackson Hole on the late Walt's personal airplane, a Grumman Gulfstream 1 that was known as the Mouse. The interior was beautifully done in mahogany wood and leather. We Howards had so much luggage from the multi-week location shoot that we loaded down that fancy plane like we were the Jode family. Walt's own wings. This was living large. I was proud of the work I did in the Wild Country and displeased that I didn't get my due in the opening credits. The movie came out more than a year after we wrapped, in December 1970. Disney held an advance screening for the press in a big theater on its Burbank campus, and our whole family was there as the lights went down. Steve Forrest got first billing, fine. Then the names of Ron, still Ronnie then, and Jack Elam shared a screen, fine. Then Frank Dacova and Morgan Woodward, Then Vera Miles got her own title card, fair enough. But still, where was Clint? And then at last came my name, in small type, sharing a title card with four other actors' names. What the hell? I was a co-lead. I was a more mature kid than I had been when making the movie. When you're young, the difference between 11 and 10 is not insignificant. But that didn't stop me from bursting into tears at my mistreatment. I felt like I had been shit on. Dad escorted me into the lobby to cool off. Bob Totten ran out too, consoling me and telling me that the crediting was unfair and a surprise even to him. I now understand that this was simply a matter of studio politics and power plays. The other actors' agents out-jockeyed my agent. 50-odd years later, it doesn't matter one whit. I rate that movie as one of my best as a kid.
I was totally on board with The Wild Country when we were making it, and Bob Totten's mentoring was a formative experience in terms of my filmmaking aspirations. Totten asked me what I was doing to further my dreams. I told him that I was making Super 8 movies in my backyard, but that I hoped to make my first feature while still in my teens. He smiled wryly. R.W., he said, using the lofty nom de tour I was keen to use, you need to ask yourself every day what you've done about being a filmmaker. Did you write something? Did you study a movie you like? Did you shoot or edit or do one goddamn thing to make yourself a film? Get the hell out of your backyard and get to it. I gave Bob a sharp nod and pledged to him that I would heed his words. But by the time of The Wild Country's release, late in 1970, I was a mere 3 months from turning 17, and frankly, I was embarrassed to be in a corny Disney movie. It felt like an extension of my Opie image, which I had finally managed to shake off at Burroughs High School. The film stiffed at the box office. I was relieved. That meant it was only around in theaters and drive-ins for about 2 weeks before it disappeared. That's a harsh thing for me to acknowledge, that I was rooting against my own movie. But that was the push-pull of adolescence in which my gratitude for all that Opie had given me existed in tension with my desire to be a man. Because I was a man, damn it. After all, I now had a car and a girlfriend. I should explain the car first. When I turned 16 and passed my driver's test, Mom and Dad granted me permission to dip into my not inconsiderable savings to buy my own wheels. I had my eye on a muscle car, a Plymouth Barracuda, the very caricature of a teenage boy's he-manly ride. I even test drove one. But unsurprisingly, my parents nixed that idea. So I settled for my plan B. A Volkswagen Beetle, a brand new 1970 model with a white exterior and red vinyl upholstery. My pride and joy. It remains in my garage to this day. Having a car was a big step forward for me. I had been the boy in the bubble wrap, the kid who wasn't even allowed to ride his bike in the streets. Now Mom and Dad trusted me to drive to and from acting jobs by myself. They still placed a hell of a lot of restrictions on me, but the simple act of having that independence and some drive time alone with my thoughts did wonders for my sense of self. Which brings us indirectly to the girlfriend. Going into my junior year of high school in the fall of 1970, I knew that I was going to be away for part of the first semester. I had landed a promising job on a new ABC comedy drama called The Smith Family. It starred the legendary Henry Fonda, whose film career was in something of a lull at that moment. Fonda played a police detective named Chad Smith. I was cast as the middle of his three children, Bob. Since you've probably never heard of The Smith Family, you already know that it didn't work out. We lasted for only a season and a half. But during the first week of school, I scrambled to get my assignments from my various teachers because I knew that I would be out of school and on a soundstage for the better part of the next 2 months. On the Friday of that week, as I prepared to leave, I ran into some girls in Mrs. McBride's English class. As we chatted, my eyes locked on a girl who was off to the side, not part of the conversation. I recognized her, the redhead who sat in the front row. She was also on the drill team that performed flag routines at halftime during our basketball games. My first thought was, wow, she looks a little like Sandy Totten. My next was, God, she's pretty. And she was looking right at me. She raised her hand and curled a finger in a come hither gesture. I left the girls I was talking to because the girl who most intrigued me had just shocked the hell out of me. I walked over to her. There was an awkward pause. Then she spoke. I know you're leaving, but are you still playing basketball this year? Yes, I'm playing. The B team, I responded. Such was our momentous first conversation. But I couldn't get it or her out of my mind. 2 weeks later, on a Saturday, I was taking the PSAT standardized test in our school library. When I turned in my test, I spotted the redheaded girl standing with some kids I knew. I had recently made a guest appearance on Andy Griffith's new CBS series, Headmaster, whose lifespan would prove to be even shorter than that of the Smith family's. Not that any of this mattered in the moment. What mattered is that I had another chance to engage with this girl. I walked over and reintroduced myself. I'm Ron, I said. I'm Cheryl, she said. I saw you on Headmaster. We talked a little bit longer, and I told her that I was worried about falling behind on homework because of my TV obligations. If I get behind on my assignments, maybe I could call you and you could, explain them or something, I said, planting the seed like the smooth operator I wasn't. She said, that sounded good. But like an idiot, I forgot to ask for her number. Cheryl, front row redhead Cheryl, occupied my thoughts all the time. At home, I looked her up in the yearbook and found out her last name, Allie. Then I checked the white pages of the phone book, looking for an Allie family in the Burroughs High School District. I found a listing for a Mr. Charles Allie on Evergreen Street in Burbank. Then I guess I stalked Cheryl. Whenever I was done shooting the Smith family, usually around 3 o'clock in the afternoon, I drove back and forth between her house on Evergreen Street and Burroughs, casing out the route that Cheryl most likely walked to and from school. I did this over and over again, hoping that I might somehow happen upon her in stride. I had it all planned out. I would roll down my window ever so casually and say, oh, hey, Cheryl, it's Ron. Ron from Mrs. McBride's class. Would you like a lift back to your place? It never worked. All I ended up doing was drive in a continuous, frustrating loop while James Taylor's Fire and Rain, the song of that season, played seemingly nonstop on my VW Bug's tinny radio. Finally, in late October, I gave up the stalking and decided that I would just call the listed number. I stared at the phone for a long time, sweating, like Bert Lahr. Then I picked it up and dialed. A man I presumed to be Mr. Charles Alley himself answered. "May I speak with Cheryl?" I said, trying to keep my voice from trembling. "Who should I say is calling?" the man asked. "Ron Howard." Cheryl came to the phone. I bullshitted her about needing help with an assignment. We were reading Charles Dickens' A Tale of Two Cities in class, and I claimed not to know what that night's homework was. She told me which pages to read. Now it was time for me to put up or shut up. "Thanks. And, hey, would you want to go to a movie with me?" "Yes," Cheryl said. "But let me check with my dad." My heart pounded in my throat while I waited. She returned to the phone. "What movie would it be?" she said. I told her that Stanley Kramer's 1963 all-star comedy, It's a Mad, 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 Mad World, was playing at the Cinerama Dome in Hollywood and that I had seen it and loved it. I thought that she might like it too. Once again, Cheryl said that she needed to check with her dad. This prompted another short wait that somehow felt like it lasted an eternity. At last, she got back on the line. "Okay," she said. Or should I say, "She said okay!" I laid out my plan to Cheryl. I would pick her up. We would catch the Sunday matinee. I would take her to dinner at Baroni's Pizzeria in Toluca Lake, and then I would drive her home. And that's exactly what happened on November 1st, 1970. The night before, I had covered my face in green makeup with dark circles around my eyes and gone out trick-or-treating with my 6-foot-tall friends, still idiotically excited about free candy. This on the eve of my first date with the woman I would end up marrying. Again, the push-pull of adolescence. But that Sunday afternoon, I combed my hair neatly and forswore my usual t-shirt and letterman's jacket, opting for a shirt with a collar and a V-neck sweater. I drove to Evergreen Street to pick up my date. Cheryl looked beautiful. She was wearing a lightweight white sweater, a navy blue skirt that was a few inches above the knee, and pantyhose that, because she was so skinny, bagged at the knees. Her long, lustrous red hair was held back by a hairband. At the Cinerama Dome, I touched Cheryl for the first time, cupping her elbow in my hand to guide her to her seat. I had seen gentlemen do that in old movies. At Baroni's, we talked nonstop over pizza, downloading the better part of our life stories to each other. Cheryl's parents were divorced, and she lived with her father, an aerospace engineer and licensed pilot who flew a single-engine Cessna. Cheryl, too, knew how to fly and was in the process of receiving her certification. She was outdoorsy, she told me, a tomboy. She and her dad went camping a lot. I told her that my dream was to direct movies. I yammered on excitedly about a screenplay for an independent picture that I was writing with my friend, Craig Hundley. That's right, I was such a film nerd that doing a story pitch was my way of trying to impress a girl. Being a gentleman, I moved to serve Cheryl a slice of pizza, maneuvering it from the metal tray to her paper plate. In my nervousness, I screwed up and flipped the slice so that it landed toppings down on the table, the tomato sauce splashing and just missing her skirt. But Cheryl just laughed. I was utterly besotted. In my mind, I couldn't believe it. Wow, my ideal actually exists on this planet. Henry Winkler later joked that I must be some kind of monstrous narcissist because to him, Cheryl and I looked like twins. I dropped her off on Evergreen Street, stood with her in front of her house, and bade her goodnight. I decided that I wouldn't try to kiss her, not this soon. But I wasn't sure about this. I worried that perhaps I wasn't being as forward as she wanted. Maybe I was blowing my chance. It turned out not to matter. Cheryl strode purposefully to her door, opened it, and then, safe on the other side of the window screen, smiled at me and said, "Thank you." Perfect. I drove home on cloud 9. A few years later, as Richie Cunningham on Happy Days, I would celebrate my dating triumphs by suggestively singing, "I found my thrill on Blueberry Hill." I was possessed by that kind of giddiness that November night. I wanted to figure out a way to convey it to my parents and Clint. Andy Griffith had a tendency, when he was in a good mood, to speak in loud, declarative sentences. "Well, that was outstanding." I remembered this and literally did an Andy imitation. I walked into the house, leaving the front door open behind me. My folks were sitting in the living room. They looked up at me expectantly. "Now that's a date," I said. I reached behind me and swung the door shut with a loud slam. Then I bounded upstairs to my bedroom without saying another word. I can only imagine what they thought happened on that date.